further says, with reference to the procedures which it suggested in the Shepherd case, we conclude that these procedures would have been sufficient to guarantee Shepherd a fair trial, and so do not consider what sanctions might be available against a recalcitrant press, nor the charges of bias now made against the state trial judge. Referring briefly to the report of the committee made to the Judicial Conference, sometimes referred to as the Kaufman Report. And I have no doubt the court is familiar with this. On page 18, we quote as follows: the committee does not presently recommend any direct curb or restraint on publication by the press of potentially prejudicial material. Such a curb, it feels, is both unwise as a matter of policy and poses serious constitutional problems. That refers to footnote in which the following is found. Both the Reardon and the Medina committees reject an extended use of the contempt power to control the news media because of the constitutional problems that would be raised and the inhibitory effect on speech that ought not to be prohibited. The Reardon committee proposes the use of the contempt power only when a serious threat to the fairness of an ongoing trial by jury is created by an extrajudicial public statement calculated to affect the outcome of the trial. The Medina committee is of the view that as a matter of both constitutional law and policy, the extension of the contempt power is neither feasible nor wise. And going back then to the report of this committee, that is the Judicial Conference Committee, we read as follows: the Supreme Court has not definitely decided whether the courts, by the use of the power to punish for contempt or by other direct measures, may control news media to the extent of requiring them to refrain from publishing prejudicial information not brought out in court, or from making prejudicial comments, whether in editorial or news reports. Now, we cite further in support of our contention that the press, and when we use the word press, of course, we refer to the right of the public to know. Sometimes, perhaps, when you use the word press, it doesn't convey to the listener what is really meant. What we mean is the right of the public to know. And the public knows only what it reads in the news or hears in the news media. That is, the public in general. So we are not interested in the press as a group of people, except insofar as it has to do with the right of the general public to know. And the founding fathers evidently felt that it was most important for the public to know. And I feel myself certainly that it was for that reason that the press was given the constitutional freedom, not because the press happened to be a group of particular people. It does not appear from the reading of the court's orders that any attempt was really made to prevent the press from reporting matters which were related to them by other persons. The first order of the court I believe, says in a general way, no one shall talk about the case, and the amendment, amended order a few days later, said no one shall talk about the case as to those things which may prejudice a fair trial. And then the later order of the 31st, I believe, of July, says these particular people here shall not talk about the trial as regards these particular subjects. And then we find a list of the subjects which those particular persons should not talk about outside of the courtroom, should not make judicial statements concerning. And the lawyers are specifically referred to, and the, if we may use the term, courthouse personnel are specifically referred to. But nowhere that we find, or any reporters referred to, or the news media referred to. Now, we say that not for the purpose of taking a position that since they weren't referred to, they could not be held to be in contempt, but we say that for the purpose of indicating that it appears to us the court's orders was certainly in line with the holding in the Shepherd case. And we have indicated here, on references to the court's opinion in the Shepherd case, that the court there did not have in mind any efforts on the part of the trial court to have this injunction apply to members of the press. Now, counsel has commented upon the fact that these gentlemen of the press, Mr. Edmondson, Mr. Hamilton, if there's any doubt in their mind, should have applied to the court for a clarification of the order. Of course, I would only say this, that I don't know what might have happened if they had been named by name or by vocation in the order. But the fact is they weren't, and it is their position that they had no notice, had no reason to apply to the court, feeling that it did not apply to them. The very wording of the order itself, where it says, in accordance therewith, the court orders a certified copy of this order to be sent by the clerk of this court to all persons named herein or subject hereto, and all newspapers. Well, the phraseology, all persons named herein or subject hereto, would, we submit, not include newspapers, where newspapers is put in with the conjunctive and, so that in one group you have the persons named herein or subject hereto, and in the other group, you have the newspapers. The implication would be that the newspapers are not subject hereto. Counsel has also said that where there is an injunction in effect, and other persons know it, may do anything which could be construed as helping, aiding, assisting, or abetting in violation of that injunction, they likewise are liable. We think counsel must have in mind the usual case of the injunction against the labor union, where all members of a particular union would be enjoined from having more than, for instance, 3 tickets at a particular location. and those three persons may be served, but the other members of the union not served. Certainly it is true when the other members know about it, they are bound by the injunction. That is a situation where there is a concert of interest, a mutuality of interest in that group. We submit there is no such mutuality of interest here between the courthouse personnel, the lawyers, as a group, and members of the press as a separate group. However that may be, we return to our basic proposition that Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Edmondson are protected on these facts here by the guarantees of the Constitution. And so we again renew our motion to quash this hire facias as to Mr. Edmondson and Mr. Hamilton on the ground that the court's power to punish for contempt is limited by the 1st and 14th Amendments to the Constitution of the United States. And punishment on these facts would be violative of their rights of free speech and freedom of the press as citizens and as members of the press. And we respectfully urge the court to grant that motion and quash the sire facias as to these.
One of the things I'd like to respond to is the arguments in the order that have been made. First, Mr. Haynes, Jr. Clear, and it must not be clear because either Mr. Haynes hadn't understood what I say or else he's beaten a dead horse. I make no argument, have never made any argument, will make no argument. There is any restriction on what any person does, says, or reports concerning a proceeding in open court. The only limitation on that is the rules in the court and the orders the court made in open court. And nobody has been criticized in any instrument drawn by this